The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport podcast on The Athletic. Matt Slater with us as usual. And the focus of today's pod, the independent fan-led review of football governance that last week delivered a wide-ranging list of recommendations designed to protect the long-term sustainability of football. Later in the pod, we'll talk to Danny Macklin, CEO of Leighton Orient, who are in League Two in the English Football League, to get his thoughts. But first up, we'll talk to Tracy Crouch, MP, who oversaw and chaired the review that has received criticism from some quarters. We'll come to the findings in a moment, Tracy, but the criticism. But first of all, what was the process like of putting this together?
It was extremely challenging. We had 6 months of taking evidence and hearing from clubs and their fan groups from across the whole of the pyramid. I was supported by a brilliant panel of experts, and I had a great team of officials working behind the scenes. But, you know, we got through it. I have to say, you know, people like Clark Carlisle on the panel, I mean, his energy was phenomenal. I mean, his Zoom stamina is now legendary amongst the sort of kind of panelists. But you know, it was challenging, but it was really interesting, you know, and there were areas of complexity that we tackled together as a team.
What was the biggest area of complexity?
Some of the nuances around financial regulation, actually. And I think that, you know, when we look at the recommendation, you know, I keep on describing it as really sexy. I mean, it's quite dry.
Not many have gone with that description, but you know, keep going.
But it's, you know, it's, I was in the city working for an insurance company when the banks went bust. And the system of regulation that we're proposing for football is very similar to the system of regulation that was set up post-banking crisis. And actually, when you talk to financial regulators and those with an interest in football, turns out that all these sort of kind of people that work in financial regulation have been sat in pubs for the last kind of 5 years going, do you know, if we applied capital liquidity to football, it would work really, really well. And so, you know, we've sort of kind of unleashed the nerdiness of all the financial regulators who also have a passion for football. It turns out that it is really interesting.
Given some of the reaction, do you think it was easier to get financial regulation through the banks than it will be to implement some of your recommendations through football?
No, I don't. I'm still...
Do you not?
Despite the reaction.
Is there as much self-interest in banking as there is in football?
No, I think there's probably less in many respects, but I think there's definitely more self-interest in football than in banking. But I'm confident and optimistic that despite the noises off, that there will still be significant and fundamental reform in football. We've already had the Prime Minister and the Secretary of State and, you know, many politicians from across Parliament, both in the House of Commons and in the House of Lords, say that there will be an independent regulator and they favour independent regulation. That's already been said. I'm confident that when people start to discuss, you know, what an independent regulator looks like and what its responsibilities are, that they recognise that the need for changes in financial regulation. You know, there is no threat to football clubs about actually having a better financially regulated system for them. It's in their interest. You know, we took evidence from Mel Morris, for example, in the middle of the crisis at Derby, and explained to him some of the things that we minded to be recommended. And I said to him, you know, if this was in place already, do you think you'd be in the situation that you're in now? And he said, no. You know, so I actually think that having a better regulated and financially controlled environment is good for football and it's good for football clubs.
Tracy, I mean, let's get to the reaction then. So, I mean, there's so much to go at. We'll start with regulation. So, we've had Christian Perzo, Karen Brady, Angus Kinnear, and Steve Parish. So four Premier League bosses, club bosses, have had a pop at you. And I think there's a sort of theme. One, regulation sort of almost by definition is government interference and it's somehow communist. I mean, you know, we've had North Korea cited, we've had Chairman Mao cited, last time I checked, I didn't know we lived in Russia. So, you know, there's a sort of theme that regulation equals communism, which I think is quite interesting. As you say, you came from the city, you're a Conservative MP. That strikes me as interesting. And then there's another sort of theme that some of them have also made, that regulation isn't a panacea. And I think that is actually interesting and something worth exploring, because it chimes with stuff we've had in the news recently about Well, everyone knows, you know, gas prices, sewage being pumped into the sea. So I think people are aware of the idea that the regulation does not equal good outcomes. Let's deal with those two things one at a time. Let's go with regulation equals communism. Discuss, Tracy.
I know, it's like, this is going to be a university degree course, yes, isn't it? Sort of kind of, this is going probably to be a, you know, a future A-level question or something. It's like Maoism versus Crouchism. you know, like, but no, I mean, I think the thing is you know, there are very few, let's be realistic, there are very few unregulated sectors in society. And those that have been unregulated are in the process of being regulated right now. So we've just set up digital markets regulation, for example. You know, we're looking at social media regulation. The worlds that you both operate in, i.e., you know, journalism is regulated. So there's very few unregulated areas. And yes, of course, some of those regulations have their flaws and don't necessarily control the crisis all the time. But one of the things about the regulator that we've proposed is actually, it's quite nimble. It can change over time to certain conditions. Somebody described it a little bit like the Gambling Commission. And trust me, I have, you know, there are questions raised about the efficiency of the Gambling Commission. But the fact that it operates a licensing system means that it can control some of the behaviours of those that it licenses. And therefore, it can change over time, you know, to those behaviours. And I think that's what we sort of kind of have in mind when you're setting up an independent regulator with control of licensing, is that when there are shocks or when there are things that appear that we haven't even thought about now because they don't exist now, you know, then actually the independent regulator can alter over time in terms of the licensing conditions. So I think it's quite a nimble or agile regulator that we've proposed. I don't think it's akin to communism. And I think that, you know, what I find really interesting is these guys, predominantly guys, you know, work in the world of business where they're perfectly fine with the businesses being regulated. And yet somehow that regulation shouldn't exist in the business of football. So they're fine, you know, being chief execs or non-executive directors of a FTSE company, which is highly controlled and regulated. But when it comes to football, no, that's communism. Right. And it's just like, how does that, I don't understand how that works.
Although to follow that train of thought, it was Karen Brady who complained that government forcing a commercial business to give away its cash and telling them how much and who to give it to could be compared to companies in Russia, China or North Korea.
Well, firstly, it's not government organisation. So it is independent of government. Like, for example, the FCA is independent of government. Sorry, Financial Conduct Authority, just for those who don't necessarily know that.
Just for those, i.e. you, Mark, who just felt really puzzled when I said that. But go on, carry on.
Mark, you are, you know, you've got a business master's degree or something. So I'm not going to assume that you don't know what the FCA means. But I don't buy it. And also, you know, the independent regulator is not necessarily forcing anyone to do anything other than make sure it's, you know, operating in a good environment. Actually, one of the things we've said is that football itself should be in charge of the redistribution of football's money. But if it can't come to that agreement, then independent regulator will. So, you know, it's no one is forcing any institution. So if they can come to a conclusion themselves on what a redistribution looks like, crack on.
Tracy, one of the things that often comes up, well, has come up for the last sort of 6 months or so, whilst everyone kind of knew that you were going to say, we need an independent football regulator. And now, presumably, we're going to talk about it for another 6 months, is what's the FA? It's the FA Premier League. What isn't the FA the independent regulator? Why do we not just rattle their cage?
Yeah, well, I think everybody understandably views that the FA is not independent of the vested interests in football. And I think that's part of the problem that the FA has. And we have sort of kind of within the report dangled the carrot in front of the FA for significant reform, for, you know, the regulator to be absorbed in the future at some point into the FA if it can reform itself significantly enough. But at the moment, I think most people are suspicious about the controls that, for example, the professional game has over some of the decisions made at the Football Authority. I think the Football Association has, of course, evolved over time. It has reformed quite significantly, but it has to do more. And I think just nobody has any confidence in the FA at the moment. And I think, you know, including clubs, including the fans. So until confidence is improved in the FA, then I don't think the FA can be the regulator.
Just go back to my sort of second point around regulation not equaling panacea, not necessarily equaling great outcomes. You know, there is sewage being pumped into the sea. You know, what on earth is the water regulator doing? That argument. So the one, I guess, that's come up in the football context is the Newcastle takeover, just because it's fresh in everyone's minds. And it was a sort of regulatory crisis, wasn't it?
No, I think it was a communications crisis.
Okay, fine. Well, is that it then?
Yeah.
The regulation actually kind of worked in that case? You know, the rule book was followed. It just wasn't very well communicated.
The current rule book was followed, yeah. I mean, I think the preface of your question is, if some say regulation is bad, then that means that they think that the current system is good. Right. That's sort of kind of the logic that we're following. Well, it can't be that good if you're seeing football clubs, you know, either go bust or teetering on the brink of going bust. You know, it can't be great if you see six clubs think that they have the power to break away from a league and, you know, effectively ruin the English football pyramid. You can't be that great if you have fans who feel completely ignored and unable to make, you know, take part in key decisions of their clubs. So I'm afraid I don't think the status quo is good enough to continue in its current form. And therefore, you know, people are crying out for reforms. One of the reasons that it's been actually, I think, relatively well received, apart from four chief exec of football clubs, is that, you know, a lot of people really do think that there needs to be fundamental reform in football.
Have those four chief execs chairs gone rogue as far as from your conversations? What has the Premier League and Richard Masters said to you?
Well, the Premier League, not just what they've said to me, they've said it publicly as well. You know, Richard came out and sort of kind of, he was quite lukewarm in his acceptance of an independent regulator, but I think he's savvy enough to recognise that that is where, you know, the rest of the world is heading in terms of, or the rest of this country's mindset is heading. And therefore it's difficult to stop, you know, an independent regulator. But do you know, that's in part the problem, right? You have 20 shareholders in the Premier League with 20 different views on this, all based on their own self-interest. And so, you know, you have cliques within the Premier League who think a regulator is a good idea. And you have cliques within the Premier League who think that a regulator is a bad idea. And somehow the Premier League executive have to navigate their way through it.
When the Premier League executive are employed, chosen by those Premier League clubs. So yeah. They can't tell those Premier League clubs what to do, can they? Because they'd very, very quickly get a vote of no confidence and be out on their ear.
Yeah, and I think the thing that we just discovered as a panel, and which you guys who follow football, you know, day in, day out will completely understand, is that, you know, you have the big six clubs complain about the tyranny of the 14, and you have the 14 clubs complain about the power of the big six. And so, you know, I don't want to say I feel sorry for the executive, because that sounds really derogatory, but actually it's really hard for, I think, the executive to navigate their way through when you've got these groups of vested interests within your shareholders. And so I kind of don't really understand why people think that an independent regulator is not the right way forward here. Surely it removes some of this headache from the Premier League and allows them to concentrate on what they're really good at, which is promoting the Premier League and driving revenue and continuing growth and getting commercial value from what is arguably the best football league in the world.
Of all of the four, I thought Steve Parish's was at least the best argued. It had, you know, I think he sat down and thought about it. And there was an interesting line in there that I do hear quite a lot. And that's, the status quo is fine. Football clubs are really resilient. They don't get liquidated very often. Bury was the exception to the rule. Macclesfield Town was the exception to the rule. And there were strange things going on there. You know, I cover both of those stories. By and large, they survive. Unlike restaurants, nightclubs, taxi firms, all the other businesses that go bust all the time. So, what's wrong? What does anything really need fixing?
I'm really interested that that's your takeout from Steve's.
Well, Parish made that point, didn't he, about the resilience of football.
So it's really interesting, because if that was the case, then why did he send me an extremely long PowerPoint presentation of all the things that needed to change in football? Right. So including, by the way, some of which are included in the report. You know, so I'm afraid I read Steve's article with interest. Let's put it that way. The one thing I would say, he's been consistent in his opposition to a regulator. That is probably the only consistency
All right. Okay. Well, let's get on to redistribution then, because what your report did, it wasn't the end, it's the beginning. It's the beginning of, and we've the last week has sort of proven that. So redistribution. Now I know you said football is, guys, it's up to you. You know, I think there's clearly a need for a conversation around redistribution. Get on with it. And you've sort of given them a couple of timeframes. And your point around parachute payments and the different timeline you've put on that, of course, was one of the things that Richard Masters didn't like, because you've said to them, by the end of this year, I'd like to hear something. So let's just go with parachute payments first of all. Yes or no, do you think they're a good idea?
Without meaning to sound like a politician, let me just sort of kind of put this into a bit of context. The report is structured in a way that distribution comes after all the regulatory changes, right? For a reason. I like to think of it in the way that you construct a really good album. Okay. This is like, you know, it's form. So you have the good regulation, good financial regulation, better corporate governance, more fan control, and so on and so forth. Because once you have all of that in place, then you have a lot more confidence in the redistribution of funds from the Premier League elsewhere into football. So let me just put that as both. This is not something that happens before good governance and good regulation. I, on parachute payments, we are clear. We think they distort competition. I don't think it is for me, or indeed government, or indeed necessarily an independent regulator, to come up with the alternative model to that. You know, this is a matter for football. So you might think I'm sort of kind of, you know, shirking my responsibilities here, but I'm afraid I don't. I genuinely think this is a matter for football. This is the system they designed. It is proving to not necessarily be the best system. Come up with an alternative.
But Tracy, hang on. How on earth, right? As we have just established, this is a game governed by self-interest, where the execs are responsible to carry out the beliefs of the majority of their clubs. So how on earth is a game that is governed by self-interest going to get together themselves and come up with something that works?
There's a micro nuance to that, Mark, which is actually for the vast majority of both the Premier League and the Championship, this is an irrelevance, right? So actually, parachute payments really only affects probably six clubs, maybe in the Premier League, and maybe 6-10 clubs in the Championship. And yet, for the Premier League to pass, you need 14 clubs, you know, for that. And you know, ditto in the Championship, you need a majority as well. And it's just like, but it's actually not relevant to many of them.
Well, it's relevant to all the Championship clubs if it distorts competition.
Well, yeah, that's true. But could the alternative model be of relevance to them? And I think that's where they're finding this difficult. So you're right, yeah, there's vested interest. But that's why we put into the report, if you guys can't come up with a solution, then commission research and independent research to look at an alternative solution for you. And if you can't do that, then the independent regulator will have a look at it. I mean, that's a long time away, right? In my mind, the earliest time that the independent regulator is going to be fully operational and functional is at the earliest, season 23-24. That's a long time to come up with some sort of kind of well thought through alternative to parachute payments. And there's many experts out there that are willing to help. So that's on parachute payments. Redistribution, exactly the same. Just on parachute payments, they're already talking. Might, you know, this is not, I haven't just come up with this in November and said, come to the end of this by December, the end of December. Actually, they've been talking all year about this. They've been talking about it forever, as far as I can tell. Draw a line under it. You can't come to a solution. Commission some independent research.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. And I think a solution is coming. I think there are three or four sort of ideas on the table of varying degrees of complexity. But, well, yeah, I think we're getting there. We're edging towards something. Now, you said that you sort of fundamentally believe that, questions of money, if you like, redistribution are best left to football. And that's, you know, guys, get on with it. But you did come up with what Richard Masters described as quite a radical idea. And it does actually strike me as quite radical. The 10% levy on transfers.
Well, first of all, I didn't say 10%. I gave an indication of a few different values. You know, I'm afraid journalists just sort of kind of went it's fine.
Summaries. Don't do executive summaries. Make us read the report.
I did. I gave you like 3 hours to read the report. But
it took 3 days.
The transfer levy for Premier League clubs on international transfers and Premier League to Premier League, right? It doesn't feel like it's that radical when post-COVID transfer window, where no fans have been in the clubs, in the stadiums for a year, and we still have like, what, £1 billion transfer window. So, you know, don't come and plead poverty when you're still buying. I appreciate that wouldn't have all been international and it wouldn't all have been Premier League, but it's still a significant sum of money. What we're saying is just distribute some of that to grassroots. The clubs, the Premier League already, through its distribution of its broadcast rights, puts, I think, a lot of money into the Football Foundation, for example, into grassroots. This is about the Premier League club's contribution. And, you know, and I'm pretty certain that they can afford it. Interestingly, the response that has been out there to criticise this is like, but we put money into academies and into players' pension schemes. I'm like, do you not get that that's a self-interest investment? Right? It's like this. I'm talking about getting it into kids' football.
They do give money to grassroots, though, don't they? I mean, they do. The Premier League give a lot to grassroots football.
The Premier League.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Premier League clubs. Mm. There's a distinction here. And it's like, you know, you want your kids that are currently playing, you know, on grotty grass pitches on a Saturday and Sunday morning to end up being Phil Foden, right? So let's actually get the clubs investing further down the pyramid into grassroots through their transfers. I don't particularly see that's a radical solution. And by the way, can I just add, it was proposed by a Premier League club. I'm not going to say who, but it was proposed by a Premier League club.
But you make a really interesting point there about this distinction between Premier League money and Premier League clubs, because I hear it all the time, and it kind of annoys me, to be honest, because what is the Premier League? The Premier League is sort of 100, 150 people that organise competitions and sell TV rights. They do all that really, really well. They kind of work for the clubs, and the clubs are just the people who happen to be at the top of our pyramid at any moment in time. The pyramid is not detached. They don't float above. We're supposed to have we're all aspiring to get there. All the teams we support are aspiring to get there. And at that time, they're there and well done, and we love that. But it's not their money. It's connected to the whole. So this is why I asked when I spoke to you last week. I did sort of want you to say a bit more about redistribution, because that is the connection, isn't it? As opposed to sort of something clever. I agree, clever and nuanced, like a transfer levy. It just seems too clever to me.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't think I've ever been called too clever before, certainly not by any of my teachers. There is a separation, I think, about, you know, the Premier League clubs themselves obviously attract talent through where they are in the, you know, in the Premier League and the amount of investment and everything else that they're willing to put into their players and their team. Some would argue in the Premier League wealth is based on the popularity of a handful of clubs. And, you know, so it's the collective power of the Premier League shareholders, but it's really being driven by, well, six, according to six of them. And, you know, so in a way, I think there is just a sort of kind of slightly different responsibility of the clubs as well.
We're banging away at regulation and redistribution, which, you know, I think is where the row is going to be. But I think we should also acknowledge that in the report, and I have properly read it now, Tracy, I completely promise you, and I've got notes here of all 47 of your recommendations. I think at least 25 of them, no one argues about at all, because they're all really, really good ideas. So I think we should sort of at least talk about some of those. So,
well, I'm slightly disappointed that you would think it's only 25.
Well, yeah.
Actually, out of the 47, how many do you think will be agreed on, taken up, and away you go without any argument? Or is it all part of a process?
First of all, there's 10 strategic recommendations and there's 47 detailed recommendations. So I think it's where you're, you know, where do you lie on the strategic recommendations? You know, we've already had the Premier League come out and reluctantly accept that there's going to be an independent regulator, ditto the EFL. You know, I mean, Rick's made his views very clear about an independent regulator, but he also is quite politically savvy. And, you know, I think he realised that if the train is leaving the station, he would at least like to be at the station, which is not perhaps where the Premier League were. And so I think the independent regulator is going to happen. financial regulation. Some might argue that the Premier League clubs need not be part of the system and structures. I think it's really difficult to sort of kind of cut that, you know, that actually only capital liquidity should apply to EFL clubs, not to Premier League clubs. But that'll be an argument. But I still think financial regulation is something that has to happen.
You can't have financial regulation for some and not for others, can you?
Well, quite exactly. That's my point.
Because then you get promoted and what? And then you're outside the financial regulation.
Well, they have that now though, right?
Yeah,
that's
they do,
part
yeah.
of the problem is they have the three different systems of, you know, financial regulation.
Yeah.
It doesn't favour anything. Corporate governance, how can you argue against good corporate governance? You know, we see it all over the place, you know, and so that's unarguable. EDI,
yeah.
Equality, Diversity, Inclusion, you know, it's an important aspect of promoting the game and again, good governance, fan involvement. Actually, you know, some clubs are already doing it. So Liverpool, for example, have already set up a consent process with their supporters group. Although we were already well on the road of coming to the conclusions that we did when we went to see Liverpool, you know, that Spirit of Shankly were explaining the work that they're doing with the club, and the club explained the work they're doing with their supporters precisely on consent issues. And they had added in consent for competition and actually rather smartly included women's competition in that as well before we had put the recommendation to bed. So actually, I'm just failing to sit here and think, why don't people think this is a good idea when you've got a club like Liverpool already doing it? How can you argue about the women's game having a separate review? You know, how can you argue about better player welfare? So I'm sort of kind of sitting there thinking, okay, obviously I know that they all think the devil's in the detail, but really the question is, do you agree with the 10 strategic recommendations?
You've convinced me, Tracy, it's more like 35 out of the 47. And I think that, I mean, come on, let's give you an opportunity to tick off some of these absolute quick wins. So have a drink whilst watching a game.
Right. First of all, let me be clear. It's a pilot scheme at the lowest level of football, right? Because actually you have this really weird situation right now. Maidstone United, my local club in National League South, right? All their fans can drink in view of the pitch when they go to a game. And actually Maidstone get a really good gate, a couple of thousand for a home game on a regular basis. It drives revenue into the club. They get promoted to National League Premier, all of a sudden their fans are considered utter yobs and unable to drink during the game. And it costs.
Well, Tracy, that's happened to me at Altrincham over the last couple of years. Go watch Altrincham in National League North. Had a little local guy from Altrincham Market brings his hut down with beer. Everybody has a little beer and watch them in National League North. Get promoted. Not possible.
It's because you're like,
hang on a minute. And I have been called that from time to time and worse, surprisingly. But that affects his business as well.
Exactly, right?
Actually, the ground's the same. The opposition's the same. The standard of football is virtually the same.
Yeah, Southend beat Altrincham at the weekend.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They were a bit lucky. But anyhow, for health
fans.
And safety reasons, we can't get all of our fans into the ground at the moment. But anyhow, that it seems utterly ludicrous.
Yeah, so a business model for a football club at that end of the football pyramid is based around other aspects of, you know, football, and it's about the spectator experience. And so to go back to Maidstone, if they get promoted to Premier, it costs them about 100 grand a year. For Dulwich Hamlet, same position, National League South, something like 60% of their revenue just gone. And so their business model is completely altered. And in fact, actually, it ends up with a slightly perverse incentive not to succeed because they can't run their football club. And you want to see success on the pitch, right? This is what, you know, it's what we as fans go to watch our teams for, is to see them win. What you don't want to see is them not win, because actually it will end up bankrupting the club. So I think we have a slightly outdated view of alcohol and football, but this is about pilot at that end of the football spectrum. It's not about going to Wembley and, you know, drinking.
British sport, Tracy, and this is a sweeping generalisation, British sport does have a problem with alcohol and drugs amongst its supporters.
Mark, you and I were both at Tottenham for the NFL game, where we saw some instances with fans throwing, you know, beer and cups.
The Euros? The Euros final?
Although that was largely outside the stadium, right? And, you know,
I presented most of that game with the smell of dope coming from somewhere around me.
Okay, so. Well, that's dope, right? That's not booze. That's a slightly different.
Well, no, yeah, I mean, no, no, I mean, but, I... no, but my point is, alcohol alcohol and drugs play, in my opinion, my experience of being at a lot of games and traveling to games, there is a booze and drugs culture around a lot of sport.
I'm not denying it. What I'm saying is that from a we were tasked with looking at financial sustainability of football throughout the pyramid. One of the things that I find bizarre is that at that end of the pyramid, that suddenly, you know, one season, you're responsible enough to drink, and a business model of a football club, which gets very few crumbs from other, you know, areas of redistribution of finances, so therefore has to rely on its fans to come in and spend its pennies, you know, sort of kind of, you know, at the club. All of a sudden, you can't do that if you get promoted.
Are you at the end of this process, to wrap it all up? Are you, at the end of the first part of this process, because there's a lot more to go for you, I know. Are you positive? Have you been disillusioned at all? Has it tested your faith in the sport and those that run it?
No, I think, you know, if anything, it reiterated my view that, you know, that both the Premier League and the EFL are very good at what they do well, which is promote competition and get commercial value, particularly the Premier League, get commercial value from its competition. You know, I'm become even more of the view that English football is the best in the world. The pyramid is the deepest. You know, we've got a huge amount of talent there. I'm confident in the growth of English football. It has been sort of kind of, you know, interesting to see some of the discussions within the shareholder groups within the Premier League and the EFL. But it's not something I hadn't seen before as sports minister. But ultimately, in the day, at the end of the process, all I wanted to do was go and watch a football match. So it hasn't actually put off me watching football, albeit I ended up watching Spurs lose. But, you know, so it really hasn't, you know, put me off the
process. Well, if anything's going to leave you disillusioned, they might be watching Tottenham at the moment.
Hey, well, got fingers crossed for, you know, the next few games. But actually, do you know what? I was sat there on Saturday morning in the freezing cold watching my five-year-old kick a ball around, and it just made me more convinced that what we need to do is get money going elsewhere throughout the pyramid. You know, you've got little kids out there desperate to kick a ball around cones, you know, play sharks and fishes with a football, and you just need to have the facilities to be able to do it.
Good stuff, Tracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So we discussed the reaction to the report from the Premier League, but what about clubs lower down the English football pyramid? Danny Macklin is the chief exec of Leyton Orient. They play in League Two, so that's the fourth division of English football. Orient are one of the founding members of Fair Game, a group of value-driven clubs supported by 40 world-renowned experts and backed by politicians of all colours. Danny, thank you very much for joining us. What's your overall reaction to the report?
I think we're excited and now ready to see the actions now for the next steps. We welcome virtually everything that's in there. There's perhaps a few bits that we'd like to see added, but predominantly everything is there. We've worked alongside Fair Game as one of the initial clubs that joined, and having spoken to those guys, I think we're eagerly anticipating the next stage with some, you know, degree of optimism, perhaps for the first time that genuinely football at our level and the pyramid can become a sustainable league and leagues.
What are you most optimistic about then?
I think the fairer distribution of wealth. There is enough game in the upper echelons of our game in this country for the pyramid that is clearly unique across the world and idolised and, you know, the envy of many other nations. And I think it has that genuine opportunity to provide for the EFL clubs alone and below that as well, but for the EFL 72 community-led clubs, for them to be run in a, you know, in a sustainable way. I don't mean sustainable financially, but also environmentally, and allow clubs to actually stand on their own two feet without having to permanently go in and dipping in the toes of of the board.
I read a couple of these earlier in the pod, but I'll read these comments to you. Angus Kinnear at Leeds. It's Maoist collective agriculturalism. Christian Perslow suggested the rest of football shouldn't benefit any more than it already does from the Premier League's popularity. Karen Brady, government forcing a commercial business to give away its cash and tell them how much and who to give it to. The last time I looked, we did not live in Russia, China or North Korea. Do you really think they're going to give more money away?
I think it's going to have to be a collaborative approach. And, you know, the government review has identified that this might require government intervention. Other sectors have it. Football is clearly a unique thing where whilst we compete together, we all ultimately want the same thing for our football clubs to be successful and to be there for our generation and future generations. And I think those quotes perhaps show how far there is to go. And it is going to need intervention to truly drive this change that is needed. I don't just mean financially, but I mean in the way the game is run in this country.
Do those quotes make you angry?
I wouldn't say angry. They're coming at a different angle from what me and the club are. But it does show that, yeah, at the moment there are two very differing opinions, and we've got to get towards, you know, ultimately that football is all about selfishness to an extent in terms of different owners, that it's a self-interest. And I get that. But ultimately, we're all responsible for the development of this game and, more importantly, for retaining what is a fantastic pyramid. You know, we as a club, we proudly gave Harry Kane his professional debut when he was on loan to us back in 2011. If he hadn't have had that opportunity, would he be where he is now? If there was no pyramid for him to go to, would he have ever have got out of the academy system at Tottenham or whatever club he would have been at? Without that, and that's just one example. As Jamie Vardy, the list goes on in terms of the importance it is for the national game as well as it is for club.
And what do you say to the argument that has been outlined in some of the reaction from those Premier League clubs that, you know, Tesco don't subsidise the corner shop, other industries are not required to hand over their money to potential rivals. What do you make of that?
Tesco are not, yeah, they're an important community partner, but they're not a community asset in the same way that pull on the heartstring of what a football club does. Football club, you're either born into or nurtured into. You know, a supermarket, everyone has their favourite, but ultimately, if that didn't exist, we'd just go to another one. You know, if Leighton Orient didn't exist, I can think of several thousand fans that simply wouldn't follow the game in the way that they do and love now.
You said that you know, you like the report. I know you do. But there was a couple of bits in there you'd like to have seen in there, for example.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of bits. I think there should be a gambling levy. I think I first heard that idea by the Price of Football podcast. The reality is there is an awful lot of betting that takes place up and down the leagues, but predominantly in the Premier League. And just a 1% or 2% levy on that, that was ring fenced for that, even if that money was used for the development of grassroots football, for academy football, I think that would really help and allow for that money to be put back in part into the game. And I think that's one key element for us that was main, but that was really the only main one. There's a few small bits, but that was really the only bit with it. Or yeah, perhaps that should be in there, but to applaud everything else that is in there.
What's your understanding, or how would you explain then? Maybe I'll turn it. Do it that way. How would you explain the golden share and how that would work?
Yeah, so in terms of the clubs being protected, I suppose, and more importantly, the fans having that protection and security around key assets, so whether that be the name of the club, the nickname, the colours, they're absolutely fundamental. We've seen previous clubs that have obviously perhaps needed that golden share so that doesn't happen. But for me, I think it's absolutely vital that those key bits are protected. Yeah, our ownership at Leighton Orient wouldn't ever dream of doing anything that of that. And if it ever did, it would certainly be in consultation with fan groups and with season card holder sponsors, etc.
Who should have the golden share and how should they sort of operate it?
Yeah, I think the devil's in the detail on that one. I think it needs to be, you know, yeah, clubs have different fan groups. I don't know if it needs to come together and say, right, we're for the purpose of this, we are one fan group. Should there ever be an issue that, you know, we will take that up with the CEO or the chairman of the club and say, look, we think this is happening or has happened. How on earth, you know, that's not allowed. And there needs to be a punishment to the clubs if they've done something like change their home kit colours from red to blue or from green to white or whatever it is, without that consultation, changing the crest, changing the nickname, etc. These are all part of our history of a club. And for each fan, that's what they bought up with, and I don't want to see things like that the crown jewels change.
Well, I was asking Tracy Crouch just before you came on about, you know, some of the things that I think nearly everybody agrees on or a good idea, you know, in the report. And we touched on the alcohol issue, that, you know, a pilot project in National League League Two, hopefully leading towards a more common sense approach to booze at games, which I think I'm sure you'd agree with. Another one that I didn't get to ask her about, but I'd love to know your view as you sit in League Two, and we're always talking to guys at your end of the game about using your stadiums better, you know, sweating your asset better, being able to get increased footfall. How do you feel about 3G pitches?
Yeah, firstly, on the alcohol one, we support the trial of it, and we're going to learn from that. But then in terms of, 4G, whatever you want to call it, synthetic pitches, yeah, we are keen to see that be allowed as a minimum. I think Tracy Crouch's wording was at least for a club such as Sutton to come up this year, and have obviously done very well, to perhaps have a period of grace, 2 years, whatever that is. If Sutton were to get relegated, I'm sure they won't from the way they've started and the way they're run, but if they were, they've spent hundreds of thousands of pounds ripping up that pitch. They've lost all the revenue from it. And if they were to get relegated, they've potentially got to consider reinvesting that amount again and then have to do it again. It's a crazy model. I know there has to be a cutoff somewhere, but we strongly encourage, and we've been speaking to League One and League Two clubs to really push this on the agenda within our CEO and chairman and owners meetings, just to really get that back on the agenda and get it discussed in a constructive way and see if there is a way forward.
But still, the principle should be that, you know, EFL football, league football should be played on grass.
I think, yeah, the tradition of it, yes. But there has to look at ways that how football can be sustainable. You know, I know if we opened up at the Brower Group Stadium, our pitch for hire for corporates and for community games and for our academy to aspire to play, our women's team, etc., it would be full every single day and night. And the reality is that is a key revenue driver, a key profit source. Yeah, we lose the club nearly £2 million a year. I think if we were allowed to have a 4G pitch, that could make a large inroad into that. And I think the pitch surfaces have developed massively. Our chairman based in Boston has seen a number of surfaces over in America. And I think generally speaking, the surfaces over there are better. But we've seen surfaces at grounds at Sutton, at Harrogate and Maidstone when we were in the National League a couple of years ago. And yes, they are different, but boy, you get used to the bounce. And you know, there aren't the injuries and the scaremongering that some say that do exist. I think it needs a real detailed review of that in a timely manner.
Sorry, Dan, did you just say you lose £2 million a year?
As a football club, in the last 2 years, we've consistently lost £2 million a year. Obviously, the pandemic, we budgeted to lose £1 million last year, and unfortunately, that was doubled through the impact of COVID.
How is that sustainable?
In the long term, it's not. We are very lucky that we have an exceptionally talented and committed board, but we have to get to sustainability, and that's why we welcome the Tracy Crouch review so much. We've got to look to reduce and are reducing our cost base whilst we continue to raise revenues at Lake Lorient. But ultimately, it's going to be external that allow us and many other clubs that are losing similar, if not in some cases, bigger amounts, so that football can be sustainable, because you know, the pot is not always there.
We have listeners in all sorts of countries around the world. So a £2 million a year loss, is that average for a League Two club? Do you know? Is that on the higher end?
It is on the higher end. It's not the highest, but it's certainly not the lowest. And we are on a road to sustainability where that loss, we want to get to break even. And we genuinely believe with Tracy Crouch's recommendations and our own measures, you know, this is not just solely relying on what those recommendations could come to fruition. This is a combination of all of those factors, whilst continuing to raise our revenues as a club.
So would you be happy to be regulated then? Are you happy as a club with working to an independent regulator? Tracy made the point to us earlier that there are very few industries in this country that aren't regulated.
Yeah, and in an industry of this size, you know, relative to other sectors, it's relatively small revenue-wise, but in terms of importance to the community and to the country, it's absolutely vital. I think that there is external, effectively just the policing of the way that clubs are owned, the way that clubs are purchased, the way that clubs are transferred, and ultimately to provide some assurances for fans that if a club is starting to go into danger, that those warning signs are very clear first up. And I think the EFL have made great strides in recent ownership with Rick Parry and Trevor Birch in doing that. I just think that an external regulator on top of that will help oversee all of the leagues, whether it be Premier League, non-league or EFL.
Danny, one of the things I often hear, and we've had a flavour of it in these responses from these Premier League bosses, club bosses, is this idea of why should we give good money to bad businesses? I mean, they're often talking about the Championship, and there's no sense of shame or responsibility about that they've created some of these conditions. But anyway, it's something that I hear quite regularly. You've just admitted that you are running a loss. What would you say to people at these clubs who say, you know, why are we giving you more money? You don't spend your own money very well. You're overspending. Just stop spending. Just stop it. Why should we give you more?
I think the reality is that nearly every club is losing money. We are losing more than we would like to, but we generally are on that road. And this year, our loss will be reduced, and next year even more without that external influence. That will get down significantly. But the reality is, we need mechanisms in place that not just improve the wealth distribution, but also allow us to find a fair expenditure model that is related to the revenue that you generate. So, yeah, there was obviously a salary cap that was put in position that was obviously challenged by the PFA. The reality is, I think the game needs a measure that is not cheatable, but is also realistic and allows a club such as Espic on Sunderland to perhaps spend a percentage of their wealth that they can afford. But the reality is they're going to be competing on a level playing field with the likes of Accrington Stanley as the stereotypical example. So it will always be that difference, and Sunderland should be able to spend within reason to the money that they generate.
That's a really good point that you raised, Sarah, because I wanted to ask that next. I mean, that is the response, isn't it, to that sort of Premier League argument. I'm painting them a broad brushstroke here, that you guys are bad businesses and you don't know what you're doing. I mean, you tried. You absolutely tried, and it didn't stick. Now, is another go at a salary cap the answer, or certainly part of the answer?
I think it just needs to have a renewed conversation. Those conversations are ongoing between PFA, between EFL, etc. But we need to find, players deserve to earn a decent salary, but it has to be related to the revenue that club is generating. We want to create competition. We want to create the ability of a club to climb the leagues through skill and desire. But it would be very good that if we've got additional money coming in, that it's not just going out in the same way that a SIB does.
One of the big issues when everyone talks about the EFL is it obviously income and media rights. So everyone knows. So the Premier League do a fantastic job of that and have done for 30-odd years. And they've just announced a blockbuster deal in the States. So everybody, that's obvious. There's been an endless conversation around the EFL. You know, the last TV deal, was it good? Was it not good enough? Did it go too far? Da, 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 da. And also around iFollow. Where do you see that going? What's the next media rights deal going to look like for the EFL? Do you think there is more potential in you being able to stream your games to people wherever they may be, to Orient fans wherever they may be?
Yeah, I think now's a unique opportunity, obviously, with the agreements up in the next couple of years. We have invested heavily into our streaming. We're blessed within our board. We've got expertise in that area. We've got a studio that wouldn't be out of place, BT Sports or Sky Sports, etc. And we're really keen to see our games shown wherever it is, whether it's on a Saturday or on a Tuesday night across the UK. I know fans that live in Yorkshire, for example, that during pandemic got to watch 46 games. Now they watch two or three that come to in the stadium and all midweek games, but they can't watch a Saturday game unless it's the international break. So we want to grow our audience in the UK and therefore our revenue to reduce that loss, but also do that overseas. You know, we are getting a few hundred every single game that previously may have had no association. And we see that as a real opportunity for not just individually, but for the league to market itself fully, especially in key markets of the Far East and the US.
Tracy earlier talked about the parachute payments, and she basically said they need to change, but she wants football to work out how they change and what they do about parachute payments. She also said that parachute payments tend to affect only maybe five clubs in the Premier League and six or eight clubs in the Championship. Would you agree with the last statement? I mean, I sort of argued with her on my views that parachute payments affect most of the Championship because of competitive balance, but arguably they stretch further down the league in who they affect.
Yeah, it has obviously a direct effect in terms of the Championships, in terms of providing an equal playing field again. A team with many millions that's received a parachute payment and perhaps received one 2 years before if they're yo-yoing between the divisions, that does create disparity, but it also creates disparity down the league. You've got teams that recently were earning parachute payments that were in League One, and the reality is that, you know, if a club is receiving parachute payments, they're artificially, perhaps not intentionally, pushing up player wages, and that filters down the leagues and does not create a level playing field.
Would you get rid of them?
I think it needs a better balance of it. You know, there needs to be, you know, if you're coming out of the riches of the Premier League into the Championship, there does need to be a cushion to fall out of that, you know, proverbial aeroplane. But whether it needs to be a full-on parachute, you know, there needs to be some sort of ground that's found. It's probably not a middle ground. It's probably more towards a ground that distribution is better distributed amongst the game. And I don't just mean the EFL, but distributed throughout the game for men and women's football.
If the independent regulator comes into play, do you feel that they would sit above everybody else and your first duty would be to what they say? And is it the independent bit that's key then? Because even the EFL board has club representatives on, you know, whether they do or whether they don't. By having club representatives on, there is an argument that an element of self-interest therefore goes on to the EFL board.
Yeah, I think that firstly, those people are removed from key decisions if there is that potential conflict of interest. I think they do that. It'd be very interesting how the IREF does, whether that sits above the Premier League and the EFL or works alongside tandem, I think.
Would you like it to?
I think it needs to sit above, and I think it truly needs independence, and it needs probably some people that have got experience of the game, they've played it, they've worked in it, but also some people that have worked in some other sectors that, you know, truly understand, you know, the complexities of other industries, so that they can help this industry make sure it stands on its own two feet.
A lot of this pod could be construed as bashing Premier League clubs for not wanting to do anything for the greater good of football. I mean, would you say from your relationships with Premier League clubs that some of them have helped you out, that there are positive elements to Premier League clubs? It's not that they all just, you know, sit there like Scrooge and try and take all of their money and not pass any of it down. That there is some help for the football community.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, we've just received half of the 330,000 that was additional Premier League money. And we're grateful to receive that. And the reality is, you know, we've received loan players that we've, you know, been able to use from clubs like Norwich and from other clubs that we've used around London. It's exactly that. There are times it feels insular and it doesn't feel like we're playing the same game, but other times there are elements that clearly do filter down the pyramid. We just think that too much filters via parachute payments, and it needs to be via solidarity payments that are far more equally split.
We had Barry Hearn on, I was trying to think now, a couple months or so ago. I mean, he was like, you know, yeah. Unsurprisingly,
it was brilliant. Yeah.
And you know, I've spoken to him over the years. I remember when he was at Leyton Orient, he was always good value there too. He, of course, flagged up the issue of West Ham moving closer to you with a massive stadium that would enable them to give out cheaper tickets. How's life been in how's life living in the shadow of West Ham these days?
Yeah, we're 2 miles apart. You look out of our stadium, the Brogroup Stadium, you can see the roof of that stadium. We pride ourselves on our catchphrase of real football in the capital, and that is exactly what it says on the tin: relatable, affordable, family-focused football. And we genuinely believe that we offer that. Certainly this season, we've seen the goals flying at the Brogroup Stadium, and that long way that continues, touch on wood. There is enough of a population around there. We have got an overlap to an extent of fans. Luckily, it's only this weekend coming. I think it's the second time in the last few years that we played at the same time or even on the same day, both at home. So we believe there's enough, and we know there are a number of West Ham season card holders that are also season card holders or regular fans. We will see a small number that will run across the Olympic Park and run to the Brogroup Stadium on Saturday to take in our game in the FA Cup against Tranmere, having watched, I think, West Ham Chelsea prior to that. So Yeah, that's a proper doubleheader for the Groundhopper.
There's a story for the Athletic.
Danny, thank you very much for talking to us and being so honest with everything. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
That's it. Thanks to Tracy and Danny for joining us. Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic and get a 33% discount. Just go to theathletic.com/footballpod, and I'll be back on Monday for The Athletic Football Podcast. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.